letzte Mal angefangen, uns in hochzuarbeiten von den einfachsten boolschen Netzwerken k gleich 1, wo es immer ein Element ist, das das andere kontrolliert, dann zu k gleich 2, wo es immer zwei Elemente gibt, die eines kontrollieren. Hier haben wir gesehen, dass es im Allgemeinen die Attraktorenlänge nicht allzu sehr wachsen kann, wenn es konstante Elemente, Funktionen gibt. Und hier haben wir nur kurz diskutiert die Fragestellung, ob es, das ist kritisch hier, und obwohl es kritisch ist, nicht alle Eigenschaften wie ein Potenzgesetz gehen, was man eigentlich erwartet hätte, weil es hier Probleme gibt zwischen den typischen und den mittleren Anzahl von Attraktoren. Und heute wollen wir uns für k gleich n interessieren. Das heißt, wir haben Netzwerke mit n Elemente und die boolschen Funktionen sind so, dass ein Element von allen anderen kontrolliert wird. Also eigentlich müsste man genau sagen, k gleich n minus 1, wenn wir genau sind. Meistens sagt man einfach k gleich n. Und das heißt, das System ist sehr sensibel, weil die Zeitentwicklung davon abhängig ist, was bei allen anderen passiert. Und wir können aber, wenn wir jetzt n gegen unendlich gehen lassen, und natürlich die Konnektivität geht dann auch gegen unendlich, eine statistische Theorie machen. Warum das? Weil schlussendlich jeder Zeitschritt einem Zufallswalk, ein Zufallsweg im Phasenraum entspricht. Also, können wir das mal ausführen. K gleich n Kaufmann. Also, wir gehen von Sigma 0 aus und dann bekommen wir, das ist also, und dann bekommen wir Sigma 1, Sigma 2 und so weiter. Das ist also Sigma T ist die Zeitentwicklung. Und jetzt können wir sagen, weil alle anderen Elemente kontrollieren, was passiert, und alle, also es ist ja schlussendlich so, vielleicht male ich das mal auf, so let's say this is sigma t, and we have the next time step sigma t plus 1. So any element, let's say this one, is controlled by all other elements. And since this is a Boolean function, it's a random Boolean function of all the, and so it's a random Boolean function of all the preceding elements configuration. This is a random new number. So overall, this corresponds to a random new state. So we can say, or it is equivalent in this limit, that this exactly corresponds to a random walk in configuration space. Omega equals 2 to the n, which is very large. So, and then that is the reason why we can now make some definite statements, because we look at this as a random walk, and we can have then statistical arguments when this random walk closes and not. So we are interested in looking in the following. We have our random walk, sigma 0 going to sigma 1 going to sigma t. And we ask ourselves, when does this one closes? Because we would like to calculate the number of all cycles. In order to do that, we introduce some probabilities and then derive a self-consistency condition for these probabilities. So we have two probabilities, Qt, which is the probability that the trajectory is not closed, so that's open. So the walk or the trajectory still open after t steps. So open means that all these states are different. If any of these states would be the same, the trajectory would be closed. So open means they are all distinct states in my random walk. And another probability, capital PT, that is the probability of terminating exactly at T. So I'm doing a random walk, I'm creating new states, sigma 0, 0, t, and now the probability that exactly at this time step I will go back to a previously visited state. So how many states are there? So here, with qt, there are t plus 1 states. So if it's open, it means open, they are all different. So I've visited t plus 1 states in total because I started at 0. And of course, if there are t plus 1 states, the probability of termination is proportional to the number of states I have. So that means that P, T plus 1, now if I do the next time step, I am terminating, equals T plus 1 divided by omega QT. So that is the probability that you have t different state, it's open, and in the next time step, you select a state which you have already visited, which is, of course, just t plus 1 divided by the overall phase space, just a probability considerations. And so that means it is... where I denote this one here as rho of t, which is the relative probability of terminating in the next time step. That means if I do not close, so if I remain open at the next time step, qt plus 1, that is then the probability that I was open in the previous time step times the probability that I have not closed, 1 minus rho of t. And so I just have to put that in. So this is in nothing else than Q of t divided 1 minus t plus 1 divided by omega. And so this is now very nice because we have a recursion relation. The same equation holds for t. So then this is nothing else than Q0 and product over I equals 1 to t plus 1, 1 minus I over omega. So I have a direct, explicit analytic expression for my probability to close the trajectory. And if I close that, I found a cycle. Now, omega is very large. Omega is exponentially large to the n. So this one I can approximate by more or less e to the minus I over omega. Because if I make it to the Taylor expansion, this is 1 minus I over omega plus higher orders. And since omega is very large, this first term of the Taylor expansion is OK. That means this one is Q0 times product over I e to the minus I over omega. And this is nothing else than Q0 e to the minus 1 over omega sum over I equals 1 to t plus 1. This I can calculate. This is just, how do you call the formula? The sum formula. Q0 e to the minus t times t plus 1 divided by 2 omega. And Q0, by the way, of course, is 1, per definition, the probability to have not closed, because I just started there, is 1. So it's an open. Yeah. So our result is then that This was Q of t plus 1, and then I made, well, I changed. I think it doesn't really matter here. So Q of t, I think at t plus 1 and t, I intermixed here, is then e to the minus t plus 1 over 2 omega. I think I, this is all correct. But this is valid for, so I would have to t plus 1. So I would have to have here a t plus 1, t plus 2, because I calculated there Q of t plus 1. So for large times, I can approximate that by t squared over 2 omega. So for large times, this is also approximately e to the minus t squared over 2 omega. So how large is then the probability to close at all? So if we remind ourselves that the probability to close is this one at times t plus 1. So the probability to close, so probability to close at any time step. So is it a well-defined probability function that I can close at any time step? So that is a probability sum over all t large p of t, because p of t is a probability close to find a cycle exactly after t time step. So if I sum over all times, it's an overall probability to find a cycle. And we know this must be 1 because we have a finite space. So I do that for large times. So I approximate here t and this t plus 1 by t. So that is more or less sum over all t, t divided by omega, which is this prefactor times q of t, which I've calculated here, e to the minus t squared over 2 omega. And I approximate that by an integral, which is easier. So I approximate this sum by an integral, from 0 to infinity dt. And actually, I can calculate that because this is just the exponential function. So this is just, if you look at that, e to the minus t squared over 2 omega at 0 and, minus here at 0 infinity, because the derivative is exactly t over omega. And so this is just 1. Of course, this is a little bit cheating because I approximated all that stuff by I did a large t expansion. I approximated by an integral, but as is the we see that this kind of approximation in the large t limit and integrating it, approximating by an integral, gives us a self-consistent normalized probability, because that means if we continue and continue and continue, in the end we have to find sometimes a cycle. So probability to find a cycle is 1, and we know this has to be 1 because the phase space is finite. So once we have that, this result, our key result here, we can now calculate the cycle length distribution. So the cycle length distribution is the probability or the expectation value, well, afterwards I have to normalize that, to have that the number of cycles of length L. So that means I calculate how many cycles I find of length L. So L is the length of the cycle. So whether I have a cycle of length 2 or 3. And how do I calculate that? I will just write the formula and then I say why it is the case. So NC of L equals Q T equals L, that I close my cycle at after t times that, divided by omega times omega over L. Why is that the case? And this, by the way, if omega divides, this is nothing else than e to the minus L squared over 2 omega divided by L. So why is that the case? So first, we used here the probability. Let me make a picture. This is sigma 0, sigma 1, and sigma t. So I close exactly here. And I have a cycle of length L if t equals L or L plus 1? I have a cycle of length qt is the probability that I am closed. Was it a cycle of length L or L plus 1? No, I'm closing here at t plus 1, yeah. Because t plus 1 equals the same, or depending how I draw that. So, yeah, I'm closing here, so sigma t plus 1 is the same. Then I have a cycle of lengths. Sorry? So again?
We have n plus 1 nodes.
N? L.
N plus 1, t plus 1 nodes, then we have n nodes.
Yeah, no, yeah, but the cycle is L plus 1 then. I think I made a mistake here. Well, anyhow, for large L, it doesn't make a difference, but I think this is L or L plus 1. Is it remains unclosed? T equals, I think I should need T equals L minus 1. I think it is.
I think I should have T equals L minus 1.
It is closed, and then I go. But anyhow, we are interested in large L. I think it should be L minus 1 here. Anyhow, so I have an open trajectory. Yeah, and I think this should be at t equals L minus 1. And then at the next time step, so when I select t plus 1, I'm closing. And then I have exactly L different states. Yeah. So what I'm doing is that sigma of t plus 1 equals sigma 0. And so the probability, so I'm open at this time step, and then the probability that I close exactly here is 1 over omega. So 1 over omega is the probability that sigma of t plus 1 equals sigma 0. Because I could select omega different states of random walk, and the probability to exactly find this one is 1 over omega. So that is why I have this factor here. Then I have q omega, that is this factor, possible starting points. So that is the number of possible starting points, because I want the overall number. And then I have the factor 1 over L, that is overcounting correction, because I want to find different cycles. And let's say I have a cycle sigma 0, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, and then going back. If I start here, 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 or here, I will always find the cycle. So I will find the cycle 4 times, because I could start at any point. So I have to divide by 1 over the cycle length in order to undo this overcounting. So that is why I have this formula. I'm a little bit confused whether this is L or L minus 1. Anyhow, we are interested in the large L limit, which we will discuss now. So the key point is that the cycle length distribution, so the probability to find a large cycle, is going down exponentially. So it is exponential, unlikely to find very large cycles. And that is because the phase space is so large, and so we have small number of cycles only. So cycle length, so not small, cycle length is very small. So the average cycle length small. But what about the average number of cycles? Is the average number of cycles also small or not? So the average number of cycles is just that's the total number of cycles. The average number of cycles is just the integral over that. So nc, the average, is just the sum over L equals 1 to infinity. The number of cycles is length L. This is a little bit tricky calculation. Let me do here a new blackboard. So the average total number of cycles, I can approximate that by an integral, let's say from 1 to infinity, over the cycle length, the number of cycles is length L. And so this is an integral from 1 to infinity, dl e to the minus L squared over 2 omega divided by L. Now, this integral let us first rescale the integral before we do that. So I have a very, very large quantity, omega, and I'm interested to see omega equals 2 to the n. I'm interested how this quantity scales with n. So I would like to rescale that. So I'm using a different variables. U equals L over 2 omega square root. So then I have here in the exponent only just u squared. And I have here a dl over l, so that cancels this factor, but I have also to consider here the rescaling of the lower bound. So nc equals then just integral of 1 over 2 omega to infinity du e to the minus u squared over u. If I do this variable transformation. And so all the dependence on the system size is here now in the lower bound. Now I split this integral into two parts. This is integral from 1 over 2 omega square root by 1, but I could also take any other finite number. It doesn't actually matter which finite number I do take here. Du over u, e to the minus u squared, plus the integral from 1 to infinity, du over u, e to the minus u squared. Now, this integral is a very nice integral, which is finite. Why is it finite? Because I have here integral over a Gaussian type integral from a finite bound to infinity. So I can do this integral, maybe numerically. It's anyhow finite. So this part is smaller infinity. And therefore, we can neglect that because we will find that this part here is going to diverge. And that is because I have a 1 over u here, and I have a 1 over u, and I have a lower bound, which is diverging, which is the logarithmically. And I have a lower bound, which becomes not diverging, becomes smaller and smaller. 1 over u diverges with u going to 0. And this one becomes smaller and smaller with larger omega. So this integral is infinite. So that's why only this integral, infinite, is larger than for large n. So this is for n going to infinity. So we are only interested in the second part, in the first part. So that means we have is then approximately integral from 1 over 2 omega square root to 1. I can take any finite number. It doesn't matter because only this part is contributing. Sorry?
I don't understand why you cancel out the second integral.
Because, as I will show, this one goes to infinity with large omega, and the second one is just a finite contribution. So infinity plus something finite. So I will just do the integral, and then you see that that this is going to infinity. So this one is just 1 divided by from 1 over 2 omega. And I have here du times 1 over u. And I do here Taylor expansion, 1 minus u squared plus 1 half u fourth, and so on, because I have a finite upper bound, so I can do a Taylor expansion. And so what I see here is I have one contribution, which is 1 over u, and then I have other terms which are proportional to u and u cubed. So I can forget about them. So this is approximately 1 over 2 omega du over u, and that is a log. So this is log of u at 1 and 1 over 2 omega, and which is then just, so we have the final result, and c bar is approximately the log over what is as log over u? Something is missing my sign. 1 over 2 u, 1 over 2 u. Minus, I have the lower bound. Minus log, I was just confused. 1 over square root of 2 omega, minus minus cancels. So this is log over 2 e to the, 2 to the n square root. And so I have, this is then nothing else if I take that in front. So this is n half. This is just a constant. So that means that is approximately n half log 2. So now to your questions. So the overall number of attractors grows linearly with the number of sides. So it's going to infinity in the thermodynamic limit. And now if I consider, for example, this term here, this term is completely independent of n. So it's finite number, just 3, 4. So this finite number I can add here, of course. But in the, if I'm interested in the scaling for large n, this finite constant doesn't count. So that is the reason why I could neglect that. I can calculate that, but for large n, it doesn't contribute because it's independent of n. Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be n plus 1 over 2? Mm-hmm. 2 times 2 to the n is 2.
Yeah, can do that. So I put this n plus 1 here to the constant. Yeah. N plus 1 is correct, yeah. Because I'm interested, yeah, I can, I'm interested in the scaling with n. With large n is n, and n plus 1 is the same. But you're right. I could put here n plus 1, doesn't matter. So the key point that this is proportional to n, so extensive. So there is a large number of cycles, and which is growing linearly with a number, with the system size. So what about now, as I said, the mean cycle length, how is the mean cycle? Length. As I claimed before that the mean cycle length is small. Actually, that was not a correct statement because what I didn't take into account here, the overall number of cycles. So this is a cycle, this is the total number of cycle lengths. But in order to calculate the mean cycle length, I have also to take account how many cycles are there. So that's what we're going to do next, and to see whether it's really true that the mean cycle length is small or not. Because this is not a probability distribution function here, what we calculated, but the total number of cycles of a certain length. So the mean cycle length is, I denote that by L bar. That is 1 over the total number of cycles, nc, sum over all L equals 1 to infinity, L, and the average number of cycles is a certain length. Because this one times this one is the probability to find a cycle of length L. So I can do our approximation. So we're interested only in the large n limit. So I can approximate this one, 1 over nc, integral from 1 to infinity, dl. Now I have here exactly the same before, just that I have here now the additional L coming from here. And here I have e to the minus L squared over 2 omega divided by L. So now these two L's cancel, obviously. So this is nothing else than integral over 2 omega, or square root, sorry, nc, integral 1 over 2 omega to infinity du e to the minus u squared. I do the same rescaling. L over 2, square root over 2 omega is u. Now, since I have the L here and this L here, I have to do the variable transformation. So that's why I get a factor 2, square root of 2 omega here. Now, this integral is, contrary to what we had before, is finite. Because this is going just to be the integral from 0 to infinity du e to the minus u squared in the thermodynamic limit when omega goes to infinity. And this is just half the normalization of the Gaussian distribution, which is something like pi over something. Or converges is something like pi or anyhow, the Gaussian what is the Gaussian again? Integral from minus infinity plus infinity du e to the minus u squared equals, somebody knows? Bitte? Bitte?
Square root of p over square root of a.
What's a p? Yeah. Okay, so then this is square root of pi r. So, any case, this is finite. That's what's important to us. And this is diverging with n. So that the mean cycle length is growing like the square root of the omega. So that is proportional to the square root of the phase space divided by n, because the average number of cycles was growing like n. So that is proportional to n 2 to the power n half divided by n. Actually, what I said before was wrong, because that was a too simple argument. So actually, the mean cycle length is very large. So we have a number of cycles which is not too large, because it's growing only with n, and the phase space is growing with 2 to the power n. But the mean cycle length is very large, because it also grows exponentially, not like exponentially with the phase space, but only with the square root of the phase space. But it's still a very large number. So we have very large cycles, actually. And we have many of them. And so that is typical for the chaotic phase. If you remember, this is in the chaotic phase. We have many cycles, and the things diverges. If we would not have enough cycles, everything would go to the same attractor, and information would be lost. We could go to the frozen phase. And the important thing to note is, so what means a large number of cycles? So here we can make a very definitive statement. So the number of cycles proportional to n is already enough to be in the chaotic phase, even if the phase space is much, much larger. So we get a feeling from this result, what does it mean to have a small number or large number of cycles? Oh. Okay, yeah. That is a good point to make a break, yeah. The idea was that we have a gene regulation network, which was at that time was a fantastic hypothesis because nobody was really talking about this kind of concept. But nowadays, everybody, there's hundreds and thousands of millions of research on gene regulation network, but at that time, this was a very theoretical proposal. And that the attractors and together with a cosine of attraction corresponds to cell types. So that the skin cell is one attractor of the human gene regulation network, and that the liver cell is another attractor. Now this is probably only, as far as we know, only true partly. Oh, that cannot be the reality, because a cell has to decide how many proteins do I produce, not just whether I produce them or not. So you say, oh, that cannot be biologically. But actually it seems that this dramatic simplification has a true kernel, in the sense that the underlying gene regulation networks, as we have in our body, is really binary, but there's an additional mechanism which regulates how many proteins are generated. So there's a so-called micro-RNA, which are very, very small RNA pieces, which are then responsible, as far as we know, so which were always considered in the past to be just leftovers, that the microRNA either express themselves as proteins, but regulate if a gene is active, whether there's a lot of transcription taking place or not. So it seems, even though this is research going on, that there's an additional mechanism regulating the quantity. So this very simplistic but audacious proposal, it surely has its true kernel. And now on this concept of living at the edge of chaos, well, we find, in most dynamic systems, that we have different phases. And in the NK network, we have also a phase transition as a function of K here. And 2 is a critical line, as we know. So here, we have a frozen phase, and we have a chaotic phase. And the hypothesis was then put forward by Kaufmann is that life is somewhere here. So life has to be in the frozen phase, because otherwise you die in daily survival. If your gene regulation network is chaotic, you will not survive the next day. But you cannot be too far from the chaotic phase, because otherwise, evolutionary-wise, you will not be able to adapt. If you're very deep in the chaotic phase and you have to adapt on a changing environment, the amount of genetic changes are just too large in order to achieve that. So the idea is that life is at the edge of chaos in the frozen phase, but not too far from the chaotic phase. And whether that's true or not, of course, it's still controversial, but it's a really very nice and cute hypothesis. So let me make a more concrete example. Namely, which has been concrete example. So this was all theory. And that is a yeast cell. So yeast is, für die, die es nicht wissen, Hefe. Das ist die Hefezelle. So that's a yeast cell cycle. And there has been a lot of research in that. So there are about 800 genes, roughly, which have been studied. And people studied, of course, the functionality of all these genes. And they tried also to study the functionality of the network. And so what some people did a few years ago was just to make a literature search, to go through all the medical literature and biochemical literature and to see which genes influence each other. And they put up the gene regulation network of these 800 genes in a Kaufmann Boolean fashion. So every gene is either active or inactive, and it has a positive or negative influence on other genes, nothing more. A very simplistic vector. And then they found that most of these genes are enslaved. So they follow the dynamic of a dynamic core. And so the dynamic core is very small. It's about, depending how you define it, 11 or 13 n equals 11 genes in the dynamic core. So they have influencing each other. So the basis of the yeast celling, of the living yeast celling, is determined by 11 genes, which regulate each other. And all the other follow what these 11 genes, the dominant ones, doing. And of course, also environmental influences. And now you might think, oh, this is really still theory. Is this really proving anything? So what these people did, and that's the key point, they didn't construct the network by themselves. They just took what they found in the research literature. And you made a plus sign if in the literature was saying, if this gene is active, it will influence positively the activity of another gene. And they made a minus sign if in the literature there was written, if this gene is active, it will tend to suppress the activity of another gene. So it was it's an extremely simplistic model. You might think that it's so simplistic it can have nothing to do with the reality, just plus and minus signs for the interactions, and the genes themselves are just plus or minus active or inactive. Then you look first at the ground state of this regulation network, and the ground state, you find that some genes are active, some genes are inactive, and in the ground state, you find it's a correct ground state, namely that is what the normal in the normal environment the gene is doing. These kind of genes are active or not active. And so the key point is the following now. There's one gene here which have some names, CLN3, which is normally inactive. So there's one, put it here, and so on, which is inactive. And now, if the cell has a good living and is increasing in size, so if the cell becomes big and fat, there are biophysical processes going on which tend to activate this gene. So it's triggering. Activate. So that means now you have a network which is in an excited state. It's not in the ground state anymore, because in the ground state, this would be inactive. But all the other genes are still in the ground state configuration. So that means now you induce a dynamic. The dynamical network, the Boolean network, will go through a dynamical states. And so what you will do is you go through here essentially four states, so G, which is a ground state, or G1. Then you go to a state S. Then you go to a state which is denoted G2 in literature. Then you go to state M. And then you go to state G1. Again, so this G1 star, which have you, this is here from the activation. So the key point is you go through the network, you find a different configuration of genes to be active at the next time step. So this is our sigma 0, this is our sigma 1, this is our sigma 2, this is our sigma 3, and so on. Just like the Boolean network. And now you go back in the ground state again, because you are in the attractor. And now you look at the literature, and so are these configurations known? And you find these are exactly the configurations which are known are the intermediate steps when the cell divides. When the cell yeast cell divides, it's a very complicated process. The genes have to be together, you have to form two new nucleus. And all these intermediate steps are defined by which genes are active and not, because everything is defined by which genes are active and not. And so you don't get some arbitrary state in your gene regulation network in your very simplistic model, but exactly the states which are known as intermediate steps of the yeast cell division cycles. And so, of course, this might be a coincidence, or you could be lucky because everything was so simplistic, and it might be that you have been lucky, but nevertheless, this is really shows you that the essence of life, the very fundament of life, the cell division, because in the end you have two cells here, can be described by very simple regulation networks. So that's a key idea of Kaufmann, namely that the gene regulation networks describe the dynamics of the gene regulation networks, describe what's going on in a living cell, is correct. The other idea, whether cell differentiation is exactly described by different attractors, is probably only partly correct. But this is a very traumatic example of how does this go. And by the way, what about life at the edge of chaos? Well, if you look at this 11-site network, so you have phase space is 2 to the omega is 2 to the 11 is 2048. That is your phase space. And you find that you have 7 attractors. But one is dominating everything because you have one living cell. So you don't want to have too many different attractors. So one, the dominating attractors has a Bayesian of attraction which has 1,067 states. It's really the dominant attractors. So you have to disturb, make something very, very funny in order to go to a different attractor. So normally you're going to the ground state attractor. So otherwise the cell wouldn't be living. So now, actually, what is the connectivity of your network? So if you calculate the average connectivity, that is very interesting. The average connectivity of the network is 27 over 8. That is 2.46. Now, this is really interesting because this is close to the critical value, which, of course, is true only in the thermodynamic limit. In the thermodynamic limit, n to infinity, 2 is the critical value. And this is in the same order of magnitude. It is not 10, or it is not 0.1. Of course, it's a small network, so it's not critical in this sense. We cannot talk about criticality. But it's very, very close to criticality given the size. So it could also be much larger or much smaller, but it's really in the same order of magnitude. Of course, it's a very small network, so it might be coincidence here, but one would need to look at other ones. It's slightly above criticality, but it doesn't really make sense because of the smallness of the network. So this is all I wanted to say here about this application to gene regulation networks. And philosophically, the influences, the implications are, of course, extremely important. If you consider that for thousands and thousands of years, people have wondered what is the essence of life, and now nowadays one can say we really know what the essence of life is. These are the underlying gene, or you could also say protein regulation network. So that is a very deep philosophical implications. Yeah, might also have other applications, of course. because we have more than gene regulation network around. Another important network, at least for us, are neural networks. Otherwise, you wouldn't be working. And with neural networks, I will just talk here very shortly. So in neural network, the situation is slightly different. There, the standard situation is you would like to have some information processing. You might, of course, have, like in a gene regulation network, its own dynamic. There are many aspects. So I'm not, I will not talk about all intrinsic possibilities in neural networks. It's, of course, a wide field. I will do that in the next summer term. I will talk more about them. But I will just say some specific possibilities here, which have been mentioned close to criticality. So first of all, the question of attractors, cyclic attractors, and chaotic dynamics is very much discussed in the brain. So some indications are that some properties of the neural dynamics in the brain look like chaos, but it could also be just looking like induced noise. So there are many, many issues. So I don't want to touch them there in this 5 minutes. But an interesting question, which is very much related to this Boolean networks, is critical information process, critical sensory sensory input processing. Input testing. And that is the following. You know probably that your eyes and other sensory organs are very sensible, namely they work logarithmically, so you can see at very large, very small light intensity and large. So what you have to do is when the intensity of the light increases with a certain function linearly, that that you want to. So let's say this is a physical input. So the number of photons, let's say, which on the retina, and the number of photons on your retina can be a very large extent. But the neural activity behind that cannot be just directly proportional. It must be a nonlinear function. It must be a highly nonlinear function. Because if this is a light intensity and this is a number of photons on the retina, the neural activity behind that must be highly nonlinear. Why that? Because whether you have one photon per second or 10 to the 23 photons per second, you cannot have such a dynamic range of the neural activity. The neural neuron can fire once or 100 times a second. That's it. So your dynamic range of the neuron is much, much smaller than the dynamic range of your of the physical process which comes onto your sensory organs. So that means you must be extremely have extreme nonlinear information processing. And one way to achieve this highly nonlinear information processing is to have a network behind that which is close to criticality. Because at criticality, you have information processing thing over many time or length scales. So you can have a kind of Boolean network or neural network which is very similar to a Boolean network, and if you can tune it to be close to criticality, and then you look at the performance of these networks, and then you see that you really get this nonlinear sensory information processing if you're close to criticality. So that is a possibility, let's say, an application of these general principles, that if your system is close to criticality, you have a different kind of information processing, and essentially nonlinear, what you would like to have. Of course, you don't really want to be in the chaotic phase, but you don't really to be, but you can be close to the chaotic phase, and then you get the desired behavior. So what I wanted to say is these kind of notions are dynamical networks close to criticality have a wide range of applications and in biology and in our brain. So I think that's all I wanted to say about Boolean networks. And I will make now a few comments of what we're going to do next. And that is about cellular automata and the notion of self-organized criticality. So we will start the next chapter about some general concept about ideas about background concept about concepts about phase transitions. What are phase transitions in physics and in dynamical systems? And then we will discuss at length the concept of self-organized criticality. So here, what we calculated or considered here is tuned. Criticality. That means we had as an external parameter, and this was our connectivity K, we had here two, a critical part. So K is an external parameter. External because we as a constructor can change this parameter and drive the system at the critical point if we want. Now, self-organized criticality is if the system, the dynamical equations, have no special points. They can be pretty universal, but the self-organization of the system will drive the system by itself to the critical point. So that is a concept of self-organized criticality, and which is one of the concepts in complex system theory. So what we are going to do is, so from a general point of view, is now we have somehow achieved a certain basis of all kind of concept and concept system, complex system theory. Now there are many different kind of very interesting phenomena you might be studying. And one of the phenomena which you might be studying is the phenomena of self-organized criticality. As I said initially, complex system theory covers a very large area of systems and phenomena, and that is one of these phenomena. It's very famous and it's very fascinating. And so we will study models which do that, drive the system by itself to a critical point. That is the famous sandpile model. And these kind of models are often studied within the concept of cellular automata. So that's why we will also study cellular automata in this chapter. And this self-organized criticality might also be relevant for evolution. That is somehow controversial, but there's some indication that evolutionary processes are self-organized. And we will then go on to evolution in the chapter after that. But I think I will make one study start today, and I will start the next lecture. Yeah.